part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part.
So here we go. Another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. And I am Christian Horn. And you are... Tell us who you are.
I'm Ian Scheller.
Come on now. You got to be on your toes to be on Part-Time Fanboy.
I got to say, I was taking my nap. I mean, watching this week's Walking Dead.
Last night's Walking Dead. Yeah. I've seen it. Okay.
Yeah, anyway, I didn't finish it. I'm going to finish it after the podcast. yes, I got quite drowsy.
It is a little bit of a kind of a downbeat, mellow episode this week, don't you think?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we don't have to listen to you bitch about Walking Dead again.
And no one needs to hear that again.
What we're really here to discuss is you... recently discovered, or you, I think you emailed me this week, right?
I did.
And you were like, there's this documentary.
Yeah, there's this documentary. I don't know how I stumbled upon to it. I guess as I was just looking at YouTube stuff, you know, movie trailers, etc., I came across the Image Revolution documentary, and I'm like, oh, this is cool. So obviously first instinct is just see if it's posted, because sometimes people obviously just put stuff on YouTube or Daily Motion and it's just sitting out there, and you know, sometimes stuff's not taken down, so it's not necessarily illegal to watch it. Couldn't find it, but then found the actual page of the production company, and it seemed it was just a very small production company. They were selling it for PayPal, and I emailed you and contact you, say, hey, have you seen this? I'm gonna buy it. Turned out you had it.
I'd actually heard about it, like that it was in production like several years ago, and or like a couple of years ago, and then when it was released I bought it, and then I just guess I forgot that I had it. Like, I had it sitting around and I meant to watch it, because they also did like an hour-long documentary about the Chris Claremont, the writer of X-Men back in the day.
Interesting. Same company?
Yeah, same company.
Oh, okay.
Sequart.org. Sequart, I guess that's what they call themselves.
Yeah.
And the Chris Claremont thing was okay. It wasn't great. It was good. And then for some reason, I just never found the time to watch the Image one. I think I had meant to, like, I was going to go on a trip back east, and the trip back east never happened. And
right.
So then I forgot about it. And then you were like, oh, I heard about this documentary. I was like, guess what? I bought it. Let's watch it and talk about it on the podcast.
Yeah. It's perfect. Anything that has to do with comics history, I mean, it's just right up my alley. I love it. I love really finding out what the behind the scenes were, and especially with this. To me, I really enjoyed learning about the beginning, middle, and end. And they did mention the future and the current state of Image Comics, but I thought it was just really good to be filled in on that, because I only saw it from one particular angle. When Image was created.
Yeah. Well, there's also a lot of that stuff. And, you know, I dug the book out after I watched the documentary this afternoon, the Marvel, The Untold Story book.
Yes.
Which is a great read, and also can be a bit depressing, as I've said before on the podcast, how the sausage is made. I've always been fascinated by Image because... I think currently what they're doing now is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of indie companies out there, but I don't think that any of them stand alongside Image as far as the breadth of original material that Image is producing, and the diversity of you know, types of stories that Image, you know, it's almost like Image Comics became Vertigo, like DC Vertigo.
Yes.
But even more so, you know, and yeah, I mean, I'm a big Image Comics fan. So, and I'm a big Walking Dead comics fan. But yeah, I was like, when you reminded me that I had it, I was like, damn, I got to sit down and watch that thing. You know?
Yeah.
So thank you for reminding me.
Hey, my pleasure. I'm just glad we could watch it and check it out. It was, you know, production value wise, it was interesting. I actually liked how it was produced. I mean, you know, it had a main story, a lot of, you know, clips of the actual studios of the guys, a
VHS.
Lot of VHS. Yeah, a lot of just, you know, standard definition stuff, and then mixed in with, it looked like,
I don't even think it was standard definition. Yeah, a lot of it was like the way the lines on the old VCR tapes, like the tracking lines.
I mean,
all that stuff is in there.
Thank God someone was recording that, because it really helped you see what was going on. And also, I like the way they did throw in this little motion graphics, moving panels of the cartoons of the guys, you know, with certain you know, scenes that they might not have had, they kind of recreated them.
Yeah.
And I actually just enjoyed it a lot, actually.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned the production value, because I was watching it, and I watch a ton of documentaries. I mean, it's like one of the biggest reasons I have Netflix, is because there's always like new documentaries like popping up on there. And I definitely felt that this had sort of a... like a homemade feel to it.
Yes.
It didn't really have like, it didn't seem like this was a very big budget documentary, which, you know, not a lot of documentaries are, but I really feel like it was an amazing feat to get all, what is it? Six of the initial founders of Image on camera and talking about the founding of the company.
And very open about everything.
Yeah, very open for the most part. I mean, you know, I was pretty astounded as to, you know, some of the stuff that Rob Liefeld I wouldn't say slip, but let out, you know. And I found him to be the most refreshing thing on the whole documentary.
It's interesting. He was very candid, and I think because it definitely showed that he had a sort of coming of age while this was all happening.
Yeah.
And there was certain, a mirror or analogies you could propose as they did in the documentary that, hey, these guys were like rock star status. And you often see sometimes if that person who's the rock star, the performer, the actor, if they're too young, they don't know how to deal with the fame and the money and the business, and that causes them to, you know, do things that aren't cool. You know, but, you know, McFarlane, I thought, was spot on. Everything I've heard about him,
intense guy, it seems like.
Super intense. You could, and I like how they mention his upbringing, because they did say his father, you know, worked in a factory. You could kind of just tell that he got his work ethic from his dad.
Yeah.
And he's so no nonsense.
Yeah.
But he's so badass because the guy's got just this immense talent.
Yeah.
Not everyone can say what he said. He's like, hey, if someone doesn't like their haircut, go get a new haircut.
If
you don't like your job, go get a new job.
Yeah.
There's certain things that he kind of defines in his mind, like very black and white, that not all people can do. And that kind of was – that made me realize, okay, that's why he's a success, because if he does have a failure, you know, in his mind, he's probably like, F it, I'm moving on, and I'm going to forget about it. So that kind of blew me away. And I don't know. I don't even know where to start with this thing, because
why don't we start with how we discovered Image? Like our own personal, you know, because I mean, the documentary is just so full of stuff. I mean, they pack a lot in like an hour and a half, and there's actually another cut That's like 2 hours that I bought too. Yeah, there was like a mega download. Yeah, the deluxe download, which I'm going to have to watch now at some point in another whatever year, year and a half, whenever I realize that I remember that I have it again. What was your first sort of exposure to a lot? I mean, it would have to be through Marvel, right?
As far as Image?
No, as far as like the creators, like whichever creator you were into.
This was kind of like, you know, I was definitely an avid collector at this time. I would say intermediate level as far as just, I knew what books I liked. I was very aware of artists more so than writing.
Yeah, me too. Uh-huh.
I have to say though, Image, in fact, made me aware of how important writers are.
Yes, sure it did.
We'll talk about that, but... I remember getting onto the, you know, the end of the New Mutants run where all of a sudden Liefeld's name was, if you walked into a comic book store, you would hear his name.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just almost just by absorbing it out of the air. And the same thing with Todd McFarlane. And I had known some of his stuff from Incredible Hulk because I was a huge Incredible Hulk collector.
He
did a great Mr. Fix-It run when, you know, the Hulk was gray Hulk.
That's right.
So he did a lot of vague.
That must have been pre-Spider-Man.
It was around that same time because he did do Spider-Man with the cosmic powers.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. But it was basically like you would walk into the store and it was so exciting. Like
it was pretty crazy.
It was so exciting because the books were just being driven by the artwork. And which is sort of like how it was back in the day when Kirby was doing stuff.
Yeah.
The artists were driving these books hard. Now, of course, Claremont was doing a great job on X-Men, but I wasn't an X-Men reader, so I didn't really know about Jim Lee.
Yeah.
But once that New Mutants run hit, and then he continued in the X-Force, right?
Yeah.
I collected the Spider-Man stuff, and I was on board through Marvel with those guys. Yeah, is that how you found it?
Well, yeah, I definitely read Marvel. Like I was a hardcore Marvel guy growing up. I mean, I've always been like a Superman fan and it was John Byrne going over to Superman that made me pay more attention to DC at the time, because when I was younger, like it was George Perez and John Byrne up until the point where I think Jim Lee was the big guy that I really liked. And I also liked Dale Keown, but
I was just going to mention him on Hulk.
Yeah, on Hulk. I mean, Dale Keown was like unbelievable. Ever. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and he eventually went over to Image but wasn't a partner. He did this book called Pit, which was crazy.
Oh, my God.
But Jim Lee was the big guy that caught my attention on the X-Men because I was a big X-Men fan. And Jim Lee, it's really funny because I was actually talking to a professional cartoonist illustrator friend of mine who's older than me, sort of like from a different generation. And we were talking, we were discussing some of the Image guys, and I was like, oh yeah, they just captured this sort of like Japanese manga aesthetic. And he was like, what are you talking about? And I'm like watching the documentary and kind of remembering a lot of those books. They totally captured that sort of like the Japanese, like with the speed lines and the very bold like panel work and stuff like that. There was something about Jim Lee's artwork that reminded me of like Battle of the Planets, of like, you know, the giant robot fighting sort of things, like guys in armor. There was just something about that aesthetic that really sucked me in. And Jim Lee was always like my favorite at the time. And so like at that time, I mean, obviously still a John Byrne and George Perez fan, but out of that group, it was Jim Lee all the way, because I liked McFarlane because of how crazy like his line work and all and just like insane like amount of like niggling like little detail he would put in. But I thought his writing was, he's the reason that I walked away from Spider-Man. Like I was just like, oh my God, I can't read this book anymore. You know, he was doing stuff with Spider-Man I just thought was horrible. Yeah. But I remember when it was announced that those guys were leaving and forming their own company. I think I must have been around 18 at that time. Right. And I just remember even being an 18-year-old and, you know, knowing my history of Marvel and DC, like being like, whoa, holy shit, this is a big deal. This is a huge deal. Yeah,
it's a huge deal. And it felt like it, and it was just crazy because, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Dale Keown because all of these artists had sort of, I don't know, they'd all just kind of risen to the top.
Yeah.
And the work was so phenomenal and so dynamic that you couldn't ignore it. And you had to just read this stuff. And I remember once they announced the X-Men, the Jim Lee X-Men, it was like, hey, here's a chance for all you guys to get in on the ground floor. And I was like, great, I'll read this because I don't know. I never confined myself.
It must have been so confusing for you, that first issue.
Well, right, because I would always, you know, I would try to read Uncanny or I'd jump into X-Factor maybe for an issue.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, I can't make sense of this. Oh, well, if Jim Lee's starting on one, let me just do this.
Yeah.
And get in on that. So it was like, it was almost like the Image thing was really happening. Which they explained great in the documentary. And it was so nice to have that sort of like just, you know, it's like 2020 vision in a way where it's like, oh, so McFarlane, you know, kills Spider-Man at like however, you know, he sets a record on Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And I remember when Marvel was doing like platinum edition.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you remember that BS?
Covers.
And,
yeah,
and this, this is what actually started the die cut covers, the glow in the dark covers.
Yeah.
This kind of started all that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Multiple covers. I mean, this really sent the entire
speculation boom. Yeah.
Right, which they mentioned in the doc, which I love too, because I'm like, wow. And I love how they show that chart of like, hey, McFarlane kills Spider-Man.
Yep.
Then Liefeld kills X-Force.
Yeah.
Then he's the top
like
son.
Five million.
And then here comes Jim Lee at 8 million or something.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And then to almost
remember
in a weird way in the doc, I like how they show that Stan Lee moment. Stan Lee's like licking his chops. Stan Lee is like, this guy just sold 8 million copies.
Yeah.
Like Stan Lee's like, you know, having an orgasm in his pants.
Yeah.
And now did you see at this moment, I couldn't tell if Jim Lee's just like Jim Lee's sitting there and he knows. Right. I mean, he's the guy who did it. But I'm like, Jim Lee, are you getting taken advantage of or was it the cut? Like, what did you think about that part, that clip? In the doc.
Well, that was, I think they used to release videos where it was like, they would talk about the hard artists and the hard artists would talk about how they draw and all that stuff. So I think that was a part of that series or where like Stan Lee interviewed hard artists from Marvel. And it was at that time. I mean, that's the thing is like, and this is like something that we can address a little later. It's really funny because, you know, how much of the 8 million, the 3 million, the 5 million is the artists themselves doing the work? And then how much is it like marketing and the push from Marvel? You know what I'm saying? Like that's sort of the balance. Like it just seems like, and if you watch this documentary and if you lived it, you know, because it just seemed like it just was all perfect timing.
Yeah.
The way it all went down. Like everything was set up because artists had been complaining about artist rights for ages. And there's a really great episode of Fat Man on Batman, Kevin Smith's podcast, where he interviews Neil Adams about how Neil Adams had to fight for the creators of Superman to get just even their names on the comic, you know, and the little bit of money that they got, you know, for the rest of their lives at the time. So, you know, but for them to like walk out en masse and just like start a new company and tell Marvel, the biggest comic company in the world at the time, to go screw themselves. I mean, it's just huge. And it's just for anybody who wasn't there, like it's hard to relate that like how big it was, you know what I mean? Because now things are so different. There's an image is responsible for that, right? There's so many indie books. Right. There's so many companies now, you know, there's, you know, there's like what Dynamite, Dark Horse, mm-hmm. you know, Marvel, DC, you know, God knows, you know, what else, anybody, you know, and there's all these indie creators. But at that time there were only two big comic companies, and Marvel was like the 800 pound gorilla. Like, you did mm-hmm. not want to mess with them. So, I mean, I, like, watching those clips, like, those old clips of them being interviewed and, like, you know, Jim Lee sort of basking in the sunshine of Stan Lee's admiration. I mean, that must have been so huge for Jim Lee. Imagine, like, being a young kid, 20-something, meeting the guy that created, you know, the books that you were on. You must have just been like, this is the top. But, so, can you imagine how bad the culture must have been for artists, for them to be selling this amount of books, probably get, I don't know if they, that they got any cut of like the sales of the book.
But yeah, I don't think they did. I mean, it's, and that's
insanity.
The story that Rob Liefeld starts telling about McFarlane, because McFarlane is that guy who's like, hey, I'll work my butt off for you, but I don't get anything. Yeah. I don't get and there's a great quote where McFarlane says, you know, it would not have taken much.
Yeah, to keep us, to make us happy.
Right. You know what? Because, you know, you give someone a tiny bonus, or you give someone a plaque, or you give someone an extra week of vacation.
Yeah,
a watch, whatever it is. Guess what? They're going to be like, they recognize me. Awesome. I'm staying here. Yep. But there was like none of that. And when when you have an achievement of that magnitude, and you're not even going to come down to the level of your workers and say, okay, we have to acknowledge something here because this is unprecedented, then you're going to get that kind of a thing. Only though, like you said, if the timing is perfect, because it's almost like they form their own mini union.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. In a way. Absolutely.
And because their talents were so in demand because of the marketing.
Yeah.
And also because there was nothing happen. I mean, that's interesting to me, because I know the marketing does play into effect. And I know a lot of people will make the argument, well, what about all the guys that created those characters beforehand to get you to the point where you could take over the book, right?
Absolutely.
But still, you walked into the comic book store. No one was doing layouts like those guys, because it was, you opened a Liefeld book and it was like everyone was, those guys were on like freaking just yelling and screaming, even if they were just talking to each other. Like every guy was jacked and he was like ripping the comic apart as you're reading it.
That's also very interesting too, because like knowing a bit of like, you know, comic history, it's really funny because that was sort of the era where Marvel finally, and I think Marvel especially were saying like, okay, it's time to, you know, because for the longest time, DC and Marvel, they had a house style. I mean, there's even a book, How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way.
That's
and they break it down. And I think it's like John Romita, can't remember, or John Buscema, you know, one of the two guys, Johns, that you know, illustrates the book. And they're like, this is how you draw a Marvel book. This is the style. And much of Marvel's style was developed through Jack Kirby, John Romita, John and Sal Buscema, you know what I'm saying? Like these guys who started at the beginning, or maybe not at the beginning, but close to it. So you had a house style. So it seems like the mid 80s to late 90s was when Marvel and I think DC more with the writing and types of stories they were going to tell, and Marvel with the art started to like loosen the reins on how restrictive they were going to be on, hey, you got to stick with this house style. Because these guys, you know, for all the shortcomings that people, you know, give them about anatomy and perspective and the basic fundamentals of drawing, they were doing something with their storytelling that was very exciting. They were breaking down barriers. They were using speed lines like crazy. They were, you know, the anatomy was like, to, like hyper, you know, exaggerated. You know, you had Spider-Man twisting and turning muscles that didn't exist in the figures, and there was it just gave the page a dynamism that had not been there before, and that was lacking.
Right.
And so, yeah. So you have like all these like elements that were coming together to sort of, I mean, it's almost like fate, man. It's just so weird. Like all these elements that were these artists who were willing to take chances and weren't steeped in the old style, you know, because there were people that were famous before them. You know, I mentioned John Byrne, you know, right. Who could have given the, you know, Neil Adams. Neil Absolutely. Adams blows away any of those guys, any of them, any of those guys. Still to this day, Neil Adams' art destroys them. Sure. Like you can't even compare. Like you could take a Jim Lee page and a Neil Adams page and it's like, no way, the Neil Adams page. Like as great as Jim Lee is, it's like Neil Adams all the way, right? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Neil Adams is doing stuff like Batman Odyssey, but whatever, you know, I'll leave that. But my point being is like, you had artists that were like big in the comics community, but something happened in the late 80s, early 90s that just gelled and it just made them break free and say like, screw this, we're not going to take it anymore. I mean, you know, in this documentary, you know, they're saying that, you know, the whole thing that started it was like Todd McFarlane not getting an acknowledgement. But I think like one of the big things that they said in the Marvel, the Untold Story thing was like him not getting an extra copy of a poster or something.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
They did mention that too, that like he wasn't even getting like a t-shirt if he did a t-shirt. And
with his art on it.
Right. And that's another crazy thing because you do have to consider the posters, trading cards, t-shirts.
Exactly.
They were getting more than enough their share as far as profitability off those artists.
Yeah,
and then
Marvel. Yeah, Marvel.
Those guys were young enough, and especially McFarlane was savvy enough to be like, what the heck? You know, because basic business, that guy knows what he's doing. He just did.
Yeah.
And he just like, what is going on? I thought it was interesting, too, that those guys already kind of were a circle of friends in a way. They sort of knew each other.
Yeah, they ran into each other at conventions.
And they were always talking on the phone, and they seemed to already have that going on. And it really seemed like McFarlane spearheaded that whole thing. Like, guys, let's do this. And everyone was at a point in their career, because even – I thought Jim Valentino was sort of their de facto like publisher.
Yeah. Well, from what I've read, to start the publishing, they went to Malibu Comics.
Okay.
And Malibu Comics was going to publish the books for them under Image. So, and I think Jim Valentino, you know, he was on Guardians of the Galaxy and, you know, he was like, I'm jumping on board. Now, I don't think that Jim Valentino was necessarily as hot an artist as they were. But I think that he, and this documentary says it, that he had a background in publishing indie comics that they needed.
Right.
And so he was like the big brain behind sort of like the business and distribution model, right?
That was the one part in the doc I wanted more of. I wanted to hear more of, okay, what actually goes into these books coming out on time? What did he need from them to make the thing move on a weekly, daily, monthly type basis? And they had an opportunity when they did mention, hey, no one's getting their stuff in on time except Todd McFarlane.
Yeah.
Well, why was that a problem and what was happening on the publisher? And that was just the one bit because they needed a seasoned veteran, at least one, right?
Yeah.
And I think they also got it in who was running Top Cow or who ran Top
Cow? Silvestri?
Well, Silvestri was more seasoned, right? Was he older?
No, I think they were all the same age. You know, that's the other thing, too, is when you think about it, it's the fact that they made a ton of money. Because I think that they got something for the books. Like, I think they got a share of the sales. So I think that the books... alone, you know what I'm saying?
When they were at Marvel?
Yeah, when they were at Marvel. I think, and that allowed them to go off and, you know, sort of, or at least their page rates went up. Something happened where they were definitely making more money. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But only off of the books. And there's even a passage in here where you know how in the documentary, and there's a passage in the Marvel The Untold Story where in the documentary they talk about how they were going to watch an auction of their artwork. In the Marvel The Untold Story book, they start naming prices, and you were seeing pages going for like $40,000, $50,000, and I don't think they got a piece of that. And it's just like, how can you, you know what I'm saying? Like, not knowing the facts, but my point is that they were making decent money for comic book artists, and that allowed them to also take the risks because they were young. You know what I mean? Like a John Romita, somebody with a family, or somebody who was older, who'd been in the game for a long time. That's a big risk to take, you know?
It is.
And for
it
these is. Guys, again, they were young. The comics market exploded and allowed the amount of sales that caused them to get the money to be able to go off and form their own business. I mean,
yeah, and I think too, you know, fans would root for that because there's the bigger story of just like the man taking on the man.
Yeah.
And how many comic book collectors work maybe crappy jobs or they want to, you know, and bust their ass every day and never get recognized for it. Well, all of a sudden...
Indie creators, yeah.
Right. All of a sudden, these indie creators are like, hey, we're going to take this down because we know what our worth is right now. We know what our stuff's selling for at auction. We know we're not getting paid any of the proceeds for anything else we're doing. And I think that fueled it even more. So it wasn't just like, hey, these artists are amazing and they're putting out great stuff and they're forming their own company. It's like, hey, they're saying F you to the man.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. You know? And we should also mention that man was a very different man than what Marvel is today. I mean, there was a company on the verge, I think, of bankruptcy at the time, you know, that was just like, I think that they may, you know, it might have even been said that those Image guys were helping keep the company afloat. You know what I mean? You know, because Marvel went through a bad time in the 90s, you know, and it was only sort of like at the turn of the century where, you know, when Joe Quesada became like editor in chief, that he was able to sort of right the ship, you know, and pull it back into, you know, profitability, you know, and I think along with Avi Arad. But, the thing is like, there is an aspect of that, of the Image stuff, of them saying like, screw you to the man, which everybody must appreciate. You know what I'm saying?
I think so. And I liked how they talked about it first. They're like, okay, we formed this company.
Yeah.
And they basically, the story's great, how they go to Marvel and say, hey, we're gone. This is not even up for discussion. They go to DC and be like, just to let you know, we've left Marvel. We're doing our own thing. And this is also not up for discussion. But I think it was such a big hit as well when it first came out, the books, because they had really something to prove. And they were probably drawing their asses off. Number one, they're drawing characters from their childhood that are near and dear to their heart. And two, they know they have to come out strong because they don't want to be the laughing stock of the entire industry. That translates. That translates in the work. When your heart's into it like
well,
that.
Well, that's the thing. Does it, though? Because I don't know if you remember how many of those books were really good, you know, when they first came out. Like... And you said earlier in the podcast, you said like Image made me realize how much how important a good writer is.
Well, exactly. But I realized that probably, I would say, issue 16 of Spawn.
Really? Because I think with something like Youngblood, I remember.
Oh, well, forget that. That was on the first page.
No, but I mean, that was the first book, dude. That was their flagship book. That was the first one that came out. So you can't discount, you know, you're saying like, I was Spawn the first one? Youngblood was the first one.
Well, no, I realized writing on Spawn. Honestly, when the Youngblood, all I remember is just it was like opening. If you animated a kaleidoscope, took acid and then chopped the kaleidoscope in half and dumped it all over your face, That's what it felt like reading Youngblood to me. I had no idea what was going on. All I saw was just crazy art, and it was just super colorful and super animated and super bright. Yeah. And I'm like, I remember finishing the book being like, I don't know what that was, but I'm just going to keep collecting it.
Really? Because I think I didn't even get the second issue of Youngblood. I think maybe I got the second, but I think I was done with Youngblood if it even came out on time.
I don't think it did.
I don't think that Youngblood was coming out on a consistent basis. Spawn did. And I remember reading Spawn and thinking Spawn was like crazy. And picking that up, even though I wasn't crazy about, but that's the thing is you, at that time, you could not avoid the hype. Like it was just like, I have to buy this. Like I have to, I remember really liking Cyberforce because I loved, even to this day, like watching this documentary, I love Mark Silvestri's art. Like I love that guy's art so much. He was fantastic on the X-Men.
Right.
And, I remember really liking Cyberforce. But that was another book that kind of just like kind of came out when it came out. And you know, and then also Wildcats.
Wildcats and Wetworks as well.
Wetworks was crazy. I remember really liking the concept of Wetworks, but also recognizing that it was a bit of a ripoff of the Spider-Man symbiote, where it was like they had like, they had these like gold like skin armors that armor that like covered their body and like they had big guns and they were like a covert ops. I have to say, like, I don't think there was any one Image book besides Wildcats, which kind of like almost I seem to remember stopped coming out on a regular basis after like issue three. I don't think I kept up with any of them. I really loved Pitt, you know.
I couldn't make heads or tails. I wanted to love it, and I was just like,
"Are you talking about the Max or Pitt?"
No, I couldn't touch the Max. I was like, "I don't know what that is." but Max got its own cartoon.
It's true. And so did Spawn. Spawn got a movie. The Spawn cartoon is supposed to be fantastic.
The Spawn cartoon is fantastic. I haven't seen it. Have it on VHS. It's great. But just to go back to the nature of the continuity, right? So the book's coming out on time. You know, Youngblood, if I went back and looked at my boxes right now, I don't know if I made it to issue 4, 5, or 6. And I don't know if it made it that far because after this documentary, I went on to Wikipedia and read about Youngblood and it just kept starting and stopping and stopping.
Yeah, they've restarted it.
Complete train wreck. Wetworks, the same thing. I really loved
Wilt Portacio's
work. I loved his style. I loved Jay Lee's style, even though Jay Lee never came over to Image.
No, he did. He had a book called like Hellshock or something like that.
I love that super dark, expressive style, but Portacio had a very interesting thing. But I never collected Wetworks, and that same thing. It started and stopped very brief, and even the Wikipedia on that said he had lost his sister.
He
had stopped drawing, I guess he had just family obligations. So that was so that was the reason that stopped. With Jim Lee, I had no idea what happened. I know Spawn, I probably collected up to 23 or 25. I think it was Greg Capullo took over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is like McFarlane got, and that's part of what the documentary says and what I've read in other places is, you know, you had Jim Lee and McFarlane. Now they were running a business, right?
Right.
And they basically had to pay employees. They had to do the day-to-day business. So they couldn't draw as much anymore. I mean, imagine the pressure of starting your own business and then having to sit down and try and be creative on top of that.
Oh, yeah.
It must be soul crushing. You know, that's why you hire like a business manager or whatever. And, but yeah, I mean, that's why Jim Lee couldn't keep up with Wildcats. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, which, you know, a lot of them ended up, and it's the documentary talks about it as well. They went and did Heroes Reborn, right? They went back to Marvel for like $3.5 million each or something like that, right? It was Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld, right?
Yes. And that was sort of, that was an early on rift because they had the continuity issues of people not releasing the books. And then they had, let's contract ourselves back to Marvel for
our direct competition. Yeah.
Right. And they, I remember those Heroes Reborn books were good.
I remember the Jim Lee one, the Fantastic Four one. And yeah. I think Wills Portacio might have done Iron Man or something. I'm not sure. But the Avengers one was horrible. The Captain America one was terrible.
Oh, yeah.
And, but the Fantastic Four one, I specifically remember the Fantastic Four one as them. It seemed like it was a movie pitch. Like, this is what we want a movie of the Fantastic Four to be like. And I remember sort of liking the first issue. But again, you had like two issues of the Fantastic Four, and then Jim Lee was out again. Like, two or three, and he was gone.
Exactly. And by that time, I'd actually really waned down my collecting.
I'm the idiot.
No, I just remember where – so I don't know where I was. I might have been – I don't know. I just remember that I had found out later. I'm like, they went back to Marvel? I was super confused, which, again, is why I love the doc, because it kind of just put everything in perspective to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because McFarlane, right, so savvy with business. What does he do? He has the one book, Spawn.
Yeah.
And when he can't handle it or he wants to grow his business with toys – he gets he had several artists, but I do know Capullo wound up on the book. But he gets one artist. He's still scripting it, and that book comes out on a regular. And if you look at what Eric Larson did and still does,
Savage Dragon,
he just stayed with. And that, I mean, that is so commendable.
The thing that's amazing is like you, and what the documentary shows is like you had dudes who wanted to just make their comic and they were fine with that, like Eric Larson or Todd McFarlane, you know what I mean? And they're like, I'm just going to stick to one. And then you had, you know, Rob Liefeld and even Top Cow, you know, a little bit, but it seems like Rob Liefeld to a greater extent and Jim Lee were stretching themselves too thin by expanding their universe. You know what I mean?
And that's their own kind of issue, because if you did just keep it to one or two books,
the
company would still be profitable. They would still be profitable. They didn't have to say, oh, well, I guess now let's just keep whipping out books.
Well, I mean, there's that point that Liefeld makes in this documentary, which is like all of a sudden you saw all these like crossovers with the term blood in it, you know, and he's like, I didn't have to have like a house fall on me to know that, you know, they were trying to dilute my brand. So that's why I had to come out with other books. You know what I'm saying? So they felt threatened by, you know, because Marvel and DC, just like any other company, they're like, that book is selling 500,000 copies. There's nothing wrong with us like trying to ride that gravy train, right? So the more stuff that you come out with that seems similar to that, you know, of course, Marvel and DC are going to, you know, try and fight that and come up with their own sort of titles and books that sound like that. Now, I, you know, have read a decent amount about this sort of subject, you know, the history of Image. And I remember a lot of people or people saying, and it is true, that part of Image's downfall or what almost pulled them apart in the beginning is it just seemed like they went to Image and did the same exact thing that they were doing at Marvel, so that those books weren't distinct enough from what Marvel was doing. You know what I'm saying? So if you look at Wildcats, or it's pretty much the same thing as X-Force or the X-Men, right? And Marvel has, like, at that point, almost like a 25-year history of characters that people know and love. So you can see to a certain extent, and again, that raises the question to me is like, do you need a stable corporate structure to be able to keep these characters going? Because I guarantee you that there are very few people who know who like Voodoo is from Wildcats, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or even Savage Dragon. Right? You're not going to find a person on the street and go Savage Dragon and somebody will know who that is. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, there is the argument to be made that Eric Larson has been doing it for 20 years or however many years.
Yeah, it's up to issue 200.
Yeah, 200, you know, which is like 10 issues a year, right? I mean, at this point, that's close. Mm-hmm. So, but to make something a household name and to keep something stable, you know, I mean, there's a lot of those characters that they're not around anymore, right?
Well, that's interesting because even with Spawn, I mentioned to Heidi, I say, hey, do you remember that movie Spawn with Michael J. White and John Leguizamo? And, you know, she's like, no, but Spawn had an animated series on HBO, right?
Yeah.
And it had its own movie.
Yeah.
But not too many people know who Spawn is. But whether or not, though, you're, you know, whether or not that's profitable, like if you're, if you have a character and you're drawing it month to month and you've got, you know, they were saying they were doing 500,000 issues a month.
Yeah.
On one title.
Yeah.
You don't need to go crazy. I mean, maybe they were just too young and they were just like, well, let's, you know, take over the industry. You do need a business structure.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, you're going to have something. But I mean, it's like, what are your goals? Like if you're someone like Eric Larson who's like, hey, I'm going to draw this one comic as long as I can, much in the same vein that Robert Kirkman is. Hey, I'm going to do this comic as long as I can. The big difference being Kirkman's more of a writer, right?
Yeah, Kirkman's is definitely a writer. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And that's funny because that comes into play later. It's like, well, it was artist found, but at the end of the day, it's kind of funny how Image now was almost saved by a writer.
Yeah, it, yeah.
You know, but anyway, just going back to the writing issue that we were talking about, I just had to stop collecting Spawn because I'm like, it just seems so shallow to me.
Well, all those books were, I mean, let's be honest, all those early books were very, it was all about the art. It was all about, and then a lot of them were about the TNA, right? Like,
well, yeah, I guess I don't remember too much of that actually. But it, once you sacrifice continuity, you're really, I mean, comics are a monthly endeavor.
Yeah.
And once you sacrifice that, you're basically saying to your audience, eh, F you.
Yeah, to a certain extent, I think so. So, you know, I think Marvel and DC, you know, always make the argument that, like, we have to hit the refresh button to get new readers or whatever.
True.
I don't know how much I believe that, you know. But I think when you talk about continuity as far as Image is concerned, I think you might mean more consistency.
Consistency, yeah.
Because, like, again, the books didn't come out on time. A series would stop after a short time.
With no notice, too.
No notice,
yeah. You would go to the – I remember just going into the comic store, like, hey, where's the issue 2 of this? They're like, well, we're just waiting for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we were waiting for it because those guys were just driving around in rich cars.
No, according to the documentary, they were buying like Vipers and yeah. I mean, that's, and I remember hearing a story about a guy who worked, well, from a guy who owned a comic shop that I used to go to, and they were talking about Wildstorm, and this guy who was an artist at Wildstorm, I don't know who, and, you know, was Jim Lee explaining to him why he couldn't, you know, give him a raise.
Mm.
In his page rate as they were walking out to like Jim Lee's Porsche, you know, and like Jim Lee gets in the car and drives away. So you definitely had these guys. It's really funny because you had these guys start a company with the right train of thought, the right, like, oh, we want to do something. We want everyone to own their own thing. We want it to be all our own thing. But then it's like, once you start hiring employees, once you start bringing people on, once you start, it's like you just become the beast yourself, right? So now you're the dude with the rich sports car and driving around and making tons of money, and you have to have a certain amount of money that you're bringing in so that you can keep the company going and not have to lay anybody off. But maybe you shouldn't have bought that sports car or that $1 million baseball or whatever it is that Todd McFarlane bought. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's just really interesting because I think that there's a certain lesson to be learned from Image, which is like, yeah, you can go off and do it yourself, but in the end, you know, if you're going to be like Robert Kirkman, yeah, the book sales went up, but would Kirkman be considered the success he is without the Walking Dead TV show? You know what I'm saying? Like,
oh no, probably not. And even so, and you might know, do you know the answer to this? They said those first few issues of his book, which he had to trick them into publishing.
Yeah.
the first few issues at 7,000-8,000, and then they said they got more orders, so they kept it on. But was that really just it? It was just like a grassroots kind of success?
I think Walking Dead was definitely one of those things that I remember being in the comic book store. I had been collecting Walking Dead since issue one, and like every month you would, like, I remember picking up the first issue, you know, being a horror fan myself. But yeah, I think there was a lot of grassroots, you know, growth behind that book. The sales would just keep going up and up because people would discover them. And then I think the sales really jumped once the trades started coming out. And also, again, it's another historical thing. Like, that's when people started switching to trades, or when trades started coming out and, you know, they were collecting more and more runs, because for a long time, they didn't release trade paperbacks. You didn't get trade paperbacks. You had to go search for back issues. You know what I mean? And that was a whole other shift in the publishing, you know, realm. Right. Because you wouldn't get like collections of, I mean, maybe you would, but not a lot of people bought them.
You'd get graphic novels, which
you wouldn't get collections, not that much.
No.
Or like, forget about collections, comprehensive collections, where it would be like issue 1 to 10 and then issue 11, and they would stay in print, you know? That's like a relatively new thing, like within the last 10 years or so.
Yeah.
So, but it's really interesting, the grassroots nature of everything, because if you look at this documentary, like I told this story to a couple of people over the holidays when I was acting. I did an independent film, one of the very first things I did when I moved to LA. I was very excited about it. And the producer and the director were like, oh, we're going to have like Entertainment Weekly come down and interview people. And everyone's like, what, you know, wow, you're going to, and then they're like, yeah, we paid them, they're going to come down. And I was like, you know, I was like 20 years old. I was like, what? What do you mean you paid them? They're like, yeah, we paid them. You know, they come down and they do an interview. And I was like, heartbroken. I was like, what do you mean? I thought that, you know, it was news. Like, people just reported news. So like, you're looking at this Image documentary, and the way that they present it is that it was all very sort of organic. It was all very grassroots, like you said. Like, it just grew because, you know, like it was like a happening, man. You know what I mean? Like, people just glommed onto it. And I wonder how much truth there is to that. Like, were media outlets paid? Did they have a PR agent? You know, was the growth organic? What did they have a smart media person behind them? I mean, the way that this documentary plays it, or the way that all the creators play it, is like that news outlets just picked up on it, and that was it. It was off to the races, right?
Well, if you had Valentino, though, remember, he kind of knew how books were put in the marketplace.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, of course they don't address it, but you have to also realize it's a big story. And yes, there had to be some PR there. There had to be, because someone had to go to all those outlets and say, hey, all the top artists on all these top books from the biggest comic book publisher are leaving.
Yeah.
So I would say yes, because people don't realize that. Even to this day, it's like, well, where does everyone get the news from? It's like, well, someone's writing a press release and then submitting it to the news wire, which costs money. So everyone could look at a news feed and basically cherry pick the stories they want to do more quote unquote journalism on.
Sure.
So yeah, dude, there had to be press. I mean, within the industry, it was like, what, Wizard?
And
previews?
I think maybe even, like, I don't even think Wizard, I think Wizard was, like, growing at that point.
Wizard was still brand, like, pretty new, but
there
I know.
There was, like, the Comics Reporter, and there was, like, you know, and maybe some zines. And yeah, I mean, there were some comic book, I mean, I would buy them. Wizard, yeah, I think you're right about Wizard. God, Wizard.
I was reading Overstreet like a diehard, but Overstreet did not put the sort of, speaking of entertainment, did not put the Entertainment Weekly vibe that Wizard had.
Yeah.
And well, also,
and that's,
you know,
the thing, though. You're talking about major news outlets. Like, your average Joe on the street is not going to pick up on that news from Wizard magazine or whatever it
was.
Well,
and I mean, they had CNN.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what you, on this documentary, you're seeing like news footage from news outlets at the time where, you know, it wasn't like it is now, where it's like,
well,
there's news everywhere.
you got to think there might have been some people who worked in the news who were comic book fans here and there. I mean, there were a ton of X-Men readers. I mean, those books, look what they sold. 8 million on X-Men. 4 or 5, whatever it was, on X-Force.
Yeah, but
who the heck gave a crap about it? Seriously, X-Force?
Yeah.
But it's like you were there for it. I mean, there.
But that's comic book stores buying. Those aren't actual sales. Like,
there
in
was
the
PR,
hands of comic
there
fans.
Was, dude, there was PR. And I would attribute it more to McFarlane. Those guys knew. I mean, they were all in the industry, so they had. There was something there that was pushing that because it was a huge thing.
It was. It was gigantic. I mean, it was like. I mean, I think besides, like, again, and the documentary talks about this, like Kirkman catching that fire and it being the next big thing, you know, because they say towards the end of the doc or in the documentary, they're like, I've never seen anything in comics happen like this, you know, the foundation of Image. And I don't think I ever will again. And there's Robert Kirkman, you know, Walking Dead. And it's like, yes, it is happening again. He's a rock star. This thing has taken off. You know, of course, it's one person as opposed to six. But, you know, I mean, that's the thing is like, if you were there, if you were living it, if you were alive and collecting comics at the time, everyone remembers Image. Everyone remembers like, oh my God, this is the big thing. Everyone. And if you say you don't remember it and you didn't necessarily get caught up in the hype, then you weren't really collecting comics because that was just like, it's just a huge thing, man. You know?
It was totally bonkers. And I like how they actually went into what started happening as they were kind of plowing their path. I didn't realize there was beef between the studios, which they had formed. Most of it seemed to be stemming from Rob Liefeld.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And that's the sort of thing. I didn't realize that either. I did not know. I knew that some of them had their own studios. But what I did not know is how autonomous they were within the Image brand. Like, I thought that it was like it's seriously like a structure that I don't think anyone had really seen before. It's like, I have my own studio, I'm developing my own project, but it goes under this brand. And so something must have happened with Rob Liefeld where he felt threatened by the others or got like paranoid or.
Right. Well, they said he was trying to poach artists from Silvestri.
Yeah, Silvestri. Silvestri. Yeah, yeah.
And Silvestri was like, I'm gone.
Yeah.
So he leaves.
Yeah.
And someone else had left too. Did anyone else leave at that time?
I think Silvestri was the first one to leave.
And then Liefeld left, right?
And then Liefeld. Well, that's the interesting thing because the account that I heard. That I read about a long time ago was that they fired him on a phone call. And I think the quote that I heard was like, I think Todd McFarlane was the one talking and he's like, I don't know if this is legal or not, but we're letting you go. That's it. And hung up on him or something like that. But in this documentary, they cite that he quit before they had a chance to fire him, you know?
Right. So, he sent a fax or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Eric Larson sent him a fax and said, like, these are all the things that we have a problem with, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, Rob Liefeld to a certain extent was like, well, screw that, you know what I mean? And then went and formed his own imprint, you know. Maximum Carnage or something like that.
Oh, yeah. That started getting really weird.
Those were some not good books either. And you know, and then they were all like, well, why are you doing this? And so then he quits, you know, and they were all tired of him. And so at that point, and then again, Jim Lee eventually, which I remember when this happened, I remember reading it at work online.
Right. I had no idea.
Fell out of my chair that Jim Lee sold Wildstorm to DC Comics. So again, the only reason that those characters are going to have any like giant longevity is because they were sold to a giant corporate entity. They're now Warner Brothers characters, right?
Well, that's actually brilliant because there's more of a chance probably for them to get a revival, I would think.
Yeah, but how much does... I mean, in the New 52, a lot of those relaunch books were Jim Lee books.
Were they?
Know? Yeah, yeah. There were a bunch of, there was like a voodoo book and like, I think they might've tried Wildcats again.
I don't remember. I don't remember. See, I didn't even
Gen 13.
That.
I'm not sure. But
yeah, they did do Gen 13, I think. But I didn't even know he sold out to DC. I was like, that part of the documentary was like, he did what?
Like, I'm surprised you didn't know that.
No, I had no idea.
That's why he does work for DC now. Yeah.
But he's like the man.
He's a publisher. Yeah, he's like the man. He's like one of the men, like with Jeff Johns and Dan DiDio and stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, it's like you've still got McFarlane doing right. his own thing. You've got Eric Larson doing his own thing. And, you know, that's the thing is like you talk about, it's interesting that we talked about or you mentioned like how it started with artists. But right. now the biggest reason that Image is the big indie name that it is because it is really, you know how Marvel used to be the house of ideas?
Right.
Like Image is really the house of ideas. They've got like new concepts. They've got interesting things they want to try out. They give creators, you know, they get to keep their film rights. You know what I'm saying?
Like, I didn't know that. That's
yeah.
great.
And, you know, I don't know the exact ins and outs of an Image deal, but I remember talking to somebody at an Image booth at Comic-Con, and it was something like, you get to keep your film and TV rights. All we do is publish the book, and you only get paid after the book gets published and makes money or something like that.
That's amazing.
Like you don't get paid a page rate. You don't get paid. They don't pay for anything. Like but they pay for the publishing costs and I think the advertising, and that's it. If you go off and get a movie deal or something, that's your own thing, I think.
That's amazing.
So like in the end, what saved Image was, you know, obviously Kirkman becoming a partner, but also to the extent of like that we are going to embrace writers. We are going to embrace, you know, different styles of art. We are going to go outside of the box. When what the Image company started at was just basically like, we want to beat Marvel at their own game and we just want to be a Marvel clone. And they are so far from that now that it's incredible, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's impressive, you know. I look at some of the stuff that I've, you know, read in the past couple, like some of the books that they have out now, you know, Walking Dead, The Manhattan Projects, Saga, you know, those are only like three, you know. They do a lot of Brubaker stuff, you know, like Criminal.
Right.
And, you know, and it, they're just on the, on the cutting edge, you know, and there's just, while everyone else is still playing in the superhero sandbox, which is a good sandbox to play in. I like reading that stuff. You know, sure. Every once in a while, when you need a breath of fresh air, when you need something new, which all of us do when we've been reading superheroes for too long or creating our own superheroes or whatever, and wanting to be inspired. I mean, Image is the place to go, I think, right?
I think so. I mean, I was just so happy to get the full story about what happened. I was just really glad it was honest, and where it wound up is just so, I guess, ironic, but for lack of a better word.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just think, geez, Walking Dead. And again, great interviews at the end there with some of the actors from Walking Dead, you know, seemed to be like when it started. And I'm like, this is kind of amazing. Because if they didn't have that Walking Dead part at the end, you'd be like, all right, good job. But it's like, this is maybe more, it's more important now than ever.
Yeah.
And I was a little, the one thing that kind of occurred to me or just that got me thinking was, okay, so you had Kirkman come in who, and obviously became great partners with AMC. To the point of, you know, there's a talk show, right?
Yeah.
You know, and all this
Walking
other
Dead spinoff and
all the other digital stuff and whatever's happening. But it's like, are the other books, you know, how does someone get in now at this point? If you're an independent person, right? Are you going to go through DC and Marvel and try to push your portfolio that way if you're an artist? You know, or a writer, you're going to try to go that route? Or are you just going to go to Image straight away? Because it's not like Kirkman had it handed to him. He had to basically lie to get his book published.
Well, he had to work. He did Battle Pope And then, right? Yeah. And then from the way that I understand it, the very basic understanding of what I understand is that you have to have a book completed. Like you have to have like pages and stuff completed, or at least a very tight pitch and an artist ready to go and stuff like that. I don't know if they help you find colorists or whatever. I'm mm-hmm. not sure, but you have to have like a book completed and hand it to them and say, do you want to publish this? And then they look at it and then they're like, yes or no. But I don't know the intricacies of anything. I've never met or had a one-on-one conversation with anyone who has gotten a book published through Image or like, through Image. So I don't know what the intricacies of the deal are, but apparently, you know, some people, there was an article, I think the writer of, or the artist of a book called Skull Kickers that comes out mm-hmm. through Image said something like, you only make like $31 a page if mm-hmm. you're lucky, once all the advertising and the production, you know, the publishing costs are factored in.
Right.
But then you've got people like Ed Brubaker, who says like he's made a lot of money off of his books. But that's the thing. Ed Brubaker started at Marvel and DC. Right. So right. what is the answer? I mean, you know, I don't know what it is. I think the answer is to just get in wherever you can.
Right.
But
right.
if you have an original idea, it's either self-publish it or go to a publisher. And
right.
certain other publishers, from what I understand, those that will remain nameless, they won't let you get to keep your movie rights, you know, or your media rights and stuff like that.
Yeah, you'll get nothing.
Yeah, or not nothing. You'll get a piece of the cake, you know. So
well, just to, you know, by the end of that movie, you kind of just realize how different things are now. And even as I read other books, the Untold Story of the Marvel Universe touches on it. The books I'm reading now, where there were stables, there were comic book studios splattered across New York.
Yeah.
You could walk in and say, hey, I want to do this. And they'd be like, good, go over there and start erasing this guy's lines, you know, or go over there and start doing paste ups, or go over there and start lettering.
Yeah.
And you would be brought up as an apprentice.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much of that really still exists, because it's the apprentice system, I know it exists in certain fields. It still does, but I believe less and less.
Yeah.
In general, the apprentice system, like, is just not really there.
Well, I don't know. I think there's like, they're called internships now, right?
Maybe.
If you get paid or something. It's
right.
probably always been called. I mean, you probably didn't get paid much then back at Marvel anyway.
No. I just felt that I read a lot of the history, like I was saying, and it's just all these guys that just learned from each other in a studio setting, much like they showed with Liefeld and Jim Lee's studio in this thing, where it's like, hey, once in a while, Jim Lee would take us over to his art desk and basically be like,
rip it
don't
apart.
Draw. Yeah, don't draw. And you need that
as
a creator. You need to be around other guys. And it's everyone works from home now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a very different, interesting thing to me, and it gets my head spinning. I mean, I was really happy to see this movie. I thought storytelling wise it told the story that needed to be told, and I thought it told it really well, even if the budget was might have been a little low.
Yeah.
And it's pretty inspirational. At the same time, again, when I look at like Robert Kirkman stuff, and it's like, all right, so you guys got one guy you could talk about, and like you mentioned, there's a bunch of great books over there, but I was just like, wow, thank God for Robert Kirkman.
Yeah.
And in another way, it's like, well, wow, I know there are just so many great independent artists out there that, you know, it's like you got to go out there and look for the stuff sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
The Image stuff was jumping off the shelves because those guys made their work and cut their teeth on characters, like you said, that have a phenomenal history because of DC and because of Marvel. And if they didn't take that chance to just be like, F you, we want some more cred, then it's almost like, where would the indie market be?
Yeah.
And it's really kind of interesting to just think of that and know that there's always going to be something out there. you know?
Yeah.
There's always going to be great independent stuff out there, and it should always be read, because who knows where it'll lead, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, these days, like, and maybe any day, you know, indie comics, it's a tough racket, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you've got to, and Rob Liefeld says it in the documentary. He's like, comics are a pain in the ass, you know?
Yep.
Like, it's a tough racket. Like, it's not easy. Like I have a guy at work, there was a guy at work who was a phenomenal artist, and I was talking to him, you know, makes his living as an artist, like a designer and stuff. And I was talking to him, I was like, man, why don't you make a comic? And he's like, because a comic is hard.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't get paid for a comic, and a comic is a lot of work, you know? And I was like,
that's, yeah,
it was one of those moments where I kind of was like, because, you know, you and I have both tried to do our own thing, like comics wise, and we know just as much as anyone, like, how hard a racket it is, how much time it takes.
I just sent my book to the printer last week.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah,
thank you. And it's, you know, it's a volume one of just comic strips. These are just comic strips.
That's great.
And yes, you get to the point where you're like, whoa, I need a cover. I need a back cover. And all of a sudden you're in there and you're drawing. And it's the same thing Greg Capullo said on Fat Man on Batman podcast. You probably heard that interview.
I did.
He's like, hey, this isn't all roses. This is like, and I think just being a draftsperson or just drawing, whether you're drawing the human body or you're drawing comics.
Yeah.
It is the amount of focus you need to do it and do it right and be happy with it, to be happy enough to send it to a printer or a publisher.
Yeah.
That is...
Well, that's a whole bunch. That's a whole other ball of wax, right?
It is, and
killing your own demons so that your heart can go out into the world,
and just going through that process of trusting that. Okay, if I do a thumbnail, that's cool, but now I got to work out these lines, and then you got to keep taking it and working it up, and it's really something else. But I you know, being a part-time fanboy, I love it. I love reading about it, and I do love doing it. But yeah, it's hard even as a beginning, you know, beginner publisher, you know.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. The one of the things that I want to say that Image really helped with, and that's the thing, is it seems that Image helped redefine what could be art in comic books, like what style could be, like, you know, those guys, again, they changed the way that comics were being illustrated. Now, these guys were master craftsmen, but they also opened the door for different styles that might not be as professional or as, you know,
as mainstream.
Exactly. They helped open the door for people to appreciate that, to appreciate art, you know, and art didn't mean that it had to be like How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way or whatever. It could be anything. And they have helped do that. That is like a really big deal. You know what I mean? Those six guys, you know, revolutionized the way that people saw comic art, or they helped it.
Mm-hmm.
Which gives guys like you and me, or I'm not speaking for you, I'm going to speak to me, or people that I know, you know, who maybe aren't as professionally honed, you can still have that opportunity, because even if your art is, you know, a more crude than what people are used to, people appreciate that more now, you know what I'm, because they recognize it as art, and they're like, this is still cool. Like, I've seen comic artists become successful, and I've looked at their art and I've been like, this is kind of basic, but it works. So there's that. The other thing that this documentary did for me was, I don't dislike Rob Liefeld as much as I used to after.
Oh, no.
Like, I have a much bigger appreciation for him, probably as a person. And he actually seems like a type of person that would be cool to hang out with.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Sit down and have a meal with or whatever. He does have a little bit of that frat boy attitude to him.
Yeah.
But I have to say, like, okay, I'm not a huge fan of his art. I don't think that his you know, despite the problems with anatomy or whatever, you know, and, you know, some of his stuff is ridiculous, but I don't think his art is as dynamic as it used to be, because I think that he's gotten to a point, and a lot of people as they get older have gotten to a point where they're like, I don't have to put that much into it. This guy's still going to pay me $50 for a commission or whatever, $100. Right. The other thing is that, I mean, I really felt his enthusiasm for the whole thing. Like when he thought back on the time, like, how great is this, blah, blah, blah. And realizing that he was just a kid, you know what I mean? And it's just like, damn, you know, you had the world handed to you and you took it. And why would anyone, you know, there's people that are jealous, oh, you know, he's not as good as I am or whatever. Well, great. But he was there and he was smart enough to submit his name to, I remember when those 501 Levi's commercials and they were taking submissions and they were advertising on TV and radio. And then I remember his commercial. I remember seeing it on TV and being like, holy cow, there's a comic artist and Spike Lee. And, you know, so... So if anything, this documentary has given me a bit more of an appreciation for Rob Liefeld. So,
absolutely. Yeah, so, I never understood the hate, and I guess a lot of it stemmed from, you know, what he was doing. But if you look across professional athletes and you look across other industries, that's just an issue with young people who get have a lot of talent and get a lot of success early on.
Yep.
They do things that you just... that kids do, you know, they do things that the silly intern, you know, does in the office where you're like, you know, hey, you bobo, but you know, and that's kind of, and I never really understood the hate because I really love all comic artists. Like I think, you know, if you can get your, it's very rare that I'll ever look at something and say, well, that sucks. I can't do that because to me,
no, if you're, I'm not like that.
If you can, because if you can get your stuff published.
No, I mean, I am like that. I mean, I'm like, that sucks. Yeah, yeah. There's definitely stuff that I look at and I'm like, wow.
I always just think, you know, if you can get your stuff published, then you're doing something right.
Yeah, and, you're absolutely right about that, though.
And I was just glad that they all sort of just spoke very frankly. I would love to see the extras whenever we can get together and watch those. And I, man, just a great, I thought a great movie, and just a, it's nice to look back with hindsight and as a fan and really learn what happened and learn more about how they just, how they made it work, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is watching the documentary, it did take me back. And I was wow. Holy cow. Like, I really used to, and I mean, I still do, but I just used to have this unbridled enthusiasm for comic books. Like, it was just like, it was a time where it was just like, I love this so much. You know what I mean? And I still love it so much, but it was all, when I was younger, there was just more time to take it in, and there was more time to dream about, like, doing what you wanted to do and all that stuff. You know, I know it sounds like an old man, but it just really took me back to, like, just having such a pure love for it. And, you know, Image Comics and Marvel in those days was a part of that. I'm not going to lie. You know, I'm sure there's people that would laugh at us and be like, oh, you like this. And I was like, I don't care. I liked what I liked. I was young and maybe I didn't know any better, but it was fun and I enjoyed it. So anyway, so people can find this documentary at sequart.org, and it's sequart.org, and they should definitely get it. It's actually pretty cheap. It's not an expensive
it's a great,
download.
Great deal, and it's something
like 10
that,
bucks or something.
Yeah, I mean, if you're into Image, if you're into comics in general, if you were a collector, if you are, I mean, it's just something great to have. I'm, you know, I put it up there with my books on comics. It's really a piece of comics history.
Yeah.
And it was well told.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. And now I'm going to have to watch like all the extras, which, oh my God. Anyway, so this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy, investigating the Image Revolution. I am Christian Horn and I am with Ian Scheller. And thanks for listening. Hopefully we will have another episode for you next week. Take care. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
Convoy.com.